Thank you. It has been a beautiful weekend and long awaited. I have tracked what you all are doing at West City for a long time, and this is my first visit to Perth. It was worth traveling across the globe to hang out with my mate, Jared. I can't help but think if we had started the simple way over on this side of the world, it would look a lot like what they've been doing here with the Peace Tree Community and First Home Project and Love Makes a Way. It's very much the same spirit, the kind of fusion of the Pentecostal fire and the Catholic stability and liturgy and the political imagination of the Anabaptists. We're kind of like brothers from another mother, so we've had a great time, and it's a gift to see the fruit of this community and to stay with Jarrett and his community there. So thanks, brother. I'm reminded, you know, as we gather this morning, I came from down south. I didn't grow up in Philly, and I remember a story growing up about a homeless guy that came to worship on Sunday morning, and he came into kind of the fancy church, you know, and he just carried all of his bags with him. It was the only way he knew, you know. He just traveled with all of his possessions, had a few layers of clothing on, and he sat down up front to worship God. But everybody sort of looked at him like he didn't quite belong there. And sadly, the pastor came up after the service, and he said, "Sir, I don't know if you've been here before, but this is the house of God. I want you to do something. I want you to ask God this week what you should wear when you come to worship." And so a week passed, and, you know, but the next Sunday, the guy came again, just like he had the week before. He came with all of his bags and his clothes on his back, sat down. The pastor kind of preemptively before the service noticed him and came up and said, "Sir, I recognize you from last week, and I asked you to do something. Did you do it?" And the guy said, "Yeah, Pastor, I asked God what I should wear, and God said he didn't know because he's never been to your church." I kind of like that one, you know. But I think we laugh because we know all too well that we've often been good at pushing away the very people that Jesus magnetized. And sometimes we've become known more for the walls we've built than the bridges, sometimes more for our self-righteousness than for our compassion. And so this morning I wanted to come out of a parable that Jesus told that I think speaks to the time that we live in. It's an amazing story. I mean, you read some of these stories that Jesus told 2,000 years ago, and they're so relevant to the world we live in. And this is one of those. I should forewarn you, it's one of those that's kind of, it can mess with the vibe in the room. It's a pretty heavy story, but I think this is a story for such a time as this. And it's from Luke chapter 16. It'll maybe pop up on the screen here. It's, if you've never heard it before, maybe you're new to this whole church thing, and just listen with fresh ears, because it's a beautiful story. If you've heard it a million times, listen with fresh ears and lean in. So this is a story of the rich man and Lazarus that Jesus told. "There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen, and he lived in luxury every day. And at his gate was laid a beggar named Lazarus, covered with sores and longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs came and they licked his sores. Well, the time came when the beggar died, and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. The rich man also died, and he was buried. In hell, where he was in torment, he looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. So he called to him, 'Father Abraham, have compassion on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, because I'm in agony in this fire.' But Abraham replied, 'Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things and Lazarus received bad things, but now he is comforted here and you are in agony. And besides all this, between us and you, there is a great chasm that has been fixed, so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross over from you to us.' I told you it was a heavy one, you know. But I heard one pastor say, you know, you've really heard the truth of the gospel when it comforts the disturbed and disturbs the comfortable. And so this is one of those stories that the early Christians actually deeply loved. I have a whole book of sermons that the early Christians preached on this little story. And one of the things that they point out, they have such brilliance as they preached. And one of the things that they pointed out is that there's an interesting thing going on here with the names, because the rich man doesn't have a name and the poor man does. And the early Christians said certainly would have been noticed, you know, and there's something to that we should pay attention to. Lazarus is the only character in Jesus' parables, in his stories, who has a name. In fact, it's often, you know, the farmer or the king or the widow, you know, and yet in this story, that character is given a name, and his name means the one God heard and rescued. So isn't it interesting that the rich man doesn't have a name? Maybe because it could be any one of us, right? And the rich people, we know their names, right? It's a reminder that we name monuments and corporations and streets and pews, have mercy. Oh, no, you know, after our rich folks. But there are poor folks that die without anybody knowing their name, but God knows their names. A reminder that our God is personal and our God knows the names of those who die in the shadows of our world without anybody holding their hand. It's powerful, right? There's also this other thing that the early Christians point out, that it appears that the rich man is a religious guy. Because as you read this, he identifies with the story. You read on, he knows all about the prophets. When he talks of Abraham, he says, Father. He identifies with the story. It may be very likely that he was a religious man, but his religion did nothing to move him in compassion and justice, to care about the suffering right on the other side of his gated world, right? And so it's a powerful thing to say that, you know, religion is not enough. That it, in the end, the true test of our faith is how it works itself out in love and compassion to our most vulnerable people in the world. As James says, that true religion that God honors is pure and faultless as is to care for the widow and the orphan in their distress and to keep ourselves from being corrupted by the world, right? That this is true faith. And we don't know too much about the poor man except that we know that God was near to him. And we see this thing of the walls, right? And I think, boy, this rich man was living in a gated world, a gated neighborhood, where I think so often we create walls because we think we're keeping ourselves safe, but we're actually locking ourselves in. That sometimes we end up in these little worlds where we're hiding behind so much stuff, and we find that the walls we hide behind are separating us from our neighbors, are separating us from the suffering, and they're also separating us from God. Right? That the wall wasn't good for anyone. It wasn't good for the poor man or the rich man. And the sad thing is the rich man had the keys, right? And it's C.S. Lewis that said, so often hell is locked from the inside. We lock ourselves in. And so I think this parable is an invitation to be set free, right? To live without fear, to get out of our walls and our office cubicles and our picket fences and all the things we hide behind and see the suffering of the world right now. Amen? So it's an invitation, I think, it's a reminder too that in some of the richest corners of the world, studies show over and over that we have some of the highest rates of loneliness, depression, and suicide. We can be some of the richest, loneliest people in the world. And I worked in one congregation in the U.S., and I began to see that, I think this story reminds us of this, that it's not just that we have a compassion problem, but I think sometimes we have a relationship problem, right? I asked Christians around the United States. These were all folks that self-identified as strong Christians. And I asked them, did Jesus spend time with the poor? And almost all of them, over 95%, said, yes, Jesus spent tons of time with the poor. Later in the survey, I asked them, do you, as a strong Christian, do you spend time with the poor? And less than 5%, almost all of them said, no, I don't spend a lot of regular time with folks who are suffering. And I began to realize that often it's not that rich folks don't care about poor folks, but that rich folks don't know poor folks, right? That we haven't actually created ramps where we have relationships. So I think one of the most radical things we can do is make poverty personal, to begin with a real friendship, a relationship, and that's risky. You know, it's hard to even know where to start, you know? One of my friends said the hardest part about a marathon is not getting to the finish line, it's getting to the starting line, right? To actually know where to even begin friendships with people who are culturally different from us, who may be economically in a different, has seen the world differently from us, but that's where life happens, right? And Mother Teresa had a great line. She said, it may be very fashionable to talk about the poor, but still not fashionable to talk to the poor. If we really care about the poor, we know their names. That they're in our lives, we're in each other's dinner tables, in each other's homes. So I think that's the great challenge, that we can talk about justice, we can talk about poverty, we can talk about immigrants, but at the end of the day, we've got to have concrete acts of love and compassion that build these friendships. And that's tricky, you know, and I get to see over and over little expressions of that. I see some of them here in your work and Jared's work and others. And I see, as I travel, I get to see these little communities that are beautiful, radiant lights. I was in the UK and I visited this one community where it was beautiful, like all people from different walks of life, just in this house that they shared together. And I kept just meeting new people over and over. I couldn't even tell who lived there. There was, you know, and I said, how did all this start? Tell me about it. And this family said, well, to be honest, we were kind of your typical suburban family. You know, it was this husband and wife, and they said, we had never been able to have kids of our own. And we kind of found ourselves a little lonely, to be honest, and we just kind of kept getting out, you know, and we were walking through our city one day, and we met this woman who was 6 months pregnant and homeless. She found herself without anywhere to go and coming out of a really difficult situation. And we said, oh, geez, well, this can't be, you know, come back to our house, you know, we'll figure something out. They sort of thought that would be temporary, you know, but they kept living together, and they sort of just ended up hitting it off. And I'm going to switch this up here. So they ended up... It's like a puzzle. They ended up really hitting it off. They kept living together, and then they this couple said, you know, one of our dreams is to get to have a little child in our home. We've never been able to do that. So why don't you have your baby and we'll keep living together and we'll help you. We'd love to see this baby, you know, come to life. And so they had this baby in their home and then they kept living together, you know, and eventually they said, well, we're getting to live one of our dreams, which is have a child in our household, in our family, you know. And they said, what's something you dreamed of? And this new mother, she said, well, I've always wanted to be a nurse. Because, you know, I've had so many people that have walked with me as I'm healing, and I'd love to just be a nurse that I can help others, you know, heal from whatever ails them. And so the couple said to them, well, you go to nursing school, you become a nurse. We'll take care of your little baby while you're in classes, you know. And she went to class, became a nurse, and they just kept living together years and years. And that little girl began to grow up in this blended household. And then this formerly homeless mom became a nurse. And the end of the story is that the woman of that married couple eventually got very sick. She ended up having multiple sclerosis. And she began to die. But she had a nurse that took care of her as she died. And this woman who she had sort of rescued from a very desperate situation, like held her hand and became her nurse as she died. She died just a few years ago. And as you look at that family, you see something that is not born of the flesh, but born of the Spirit of God. You know that you see this family that has been come together through the grace of God. And I think that's the power of the church, right? Is that we know that our love is not limited to biological family, that our love is not limited to our nationality. Our love extends beyond borders, beyond DNA, that we have a new family. And as Jesus said, who are my brothers, who are my sister, but those who are seeking the kingdom of God, that we're doing this together. So I thought I'd just share a couple of other stories of we've seen some beautiful glimpses of this compassion in our country lately, especially when it comes to how we welcome immigrants and refugees. It's one of those things that I think your country is wrestling with, and Love Makes a Way has been a beautiful prophetic witness of. But in our country, we, you know, have so much hostile language about immigrants and refugees, and yet what's so beautiful is in Philadelphia, the church has come together, and people of faith and conscience, together with our immigrant brothers and sisters, have said, we refuse to let hate hijack the airwaves. We want to see compassion and love. And there's a movement called the New Sanctuary Movement in Philadelphia that has begun to respond to the crisis around immigration. And it's amazing because we've got churches and households that have said we are safe places for immigrants, and now our city has unanimously voted to be a sanctuary city and said we will not comply with federal deportations. Our mayor said Philadelphia means the city of love, and so we will continue to be the city of love where everyone is welcome, no matter who you are or where you come from. Powerful, right? And now, as we face possible deportations, we have an emergency response. If there's a house that's raided, an alert goes out and an address is given so everybody can go there in nonviolent resistance and prayerful solidarity to stand against the deportations. I'm proud of our city. When the Pope came to Philadelphia, he had one of our immigrant families share her testimony from the stage with him. And he pronounced the beauty of this new sanctuary movement. That call is everywhere, but it takes courage, you know, because folks are facing some really scary stuff right now in our country. And I love how the church has risen up. One of the congregations in Philadelphia is a Pentecostal church that began to welcome people. And they said, we're one of these sanctuary places, you know. And so folks began to know that they could live there while they were finding houses or other more permanent alternatives. But they said, meanwhile, you can gather here. It's safe. We'll figure it out. If you need lawyers, we'll help you get lawyers, everything, you know, very holistic. But the city came in, or the government came in at one point and said, this is not legit. Like, you don't have all the licenses and permits to run a shelter. We don't know who all these folks are, so we're shutting this down. These are Pentecostals. You don't mess with Pentecostals, you know. And they said, we're going to pray about this and we'll meet again soon. So they met back up with city officials and they said, listen, we want you to know that we respect what you're saying. We don't mean to disrespect you, but and you've said that we can't run a shelter. So we're not going to run a shelter, but we are going to be the church. And you should know that the church welcomes people. That's what we do. When Jesus said, when you welcome the stranger, you welcome me. That's what we do. So we're going to be the church. We won't call it a shelter. We'll call it a revival, because that's what this is. It's a revival, right? And you should have seen the news. Like, the news stories were trying to, you know, nuance this, and they're like, we the pastor just said they're no longer running a shelter. They're hosting a revival. Back to you, Bob. You know, and it's amazing. And they just kept going, you know. So we went one night to the revival, my buddy and I, and we went, and there's, you know, all these families there that undoubtedly would be deported or be, you know, face some really difficult circumstances if it weren't for the love and compassion of the church. And so they're sharing their stories. We worship together, and then we serve communion, you know. And after like 3 hours or so of, it was about 10 o'clock, one of the pastors goes, okay, that concludes the formal revival services tonight. The next 8 hours or so will be silent meditation and contemplative prayer. Everybody have a good night. As far as I know, that revival continues. You know that it's that scripture where Jesus said we're to be as shrewd as serpents and as innocent as doves. That I look at that community and I say that's what it looks like, I think, at such a time as this. And I also had the privilege of going down to the border where we have such, you know, talk about the wall that could be built there. And some folks have even said things as terrible as all we need is just an electrified fence that says, cross this border and die. And yet, in the midst of all of that hostility and hatred, the church has been a beautiful witness down there, and there's a sanctuary movement along the border of folks that are doing all kinds of incredible, courageous hospitality and generous love. And one of the things that they did is they said, we felt like we needed to bear witness of God's love. You know, as we're not going to wait on politicians to tell us how to treat immigrants and refugees. We actually look to the Bible and we see that it says that when we are to welcome the foreigner as if they were our own flesh and blood, because we ourselves were once foreigners in the land of Egypt, that we see this all through scripture. And so we needed to bear witness of that. As Martin Luther King said, the church is meant to be the conscience of the nation. We're meant to wake people up to the compassion of God. And so they said, we wanted to bear witness. So they organized a worship service, right, along the wall. And they invited folks on the Mexico side to meet at the wall. And then they were joined by folks on the U.S. side. And they had a worship service over the wall. And they sang each other songs in Spanish and English. And then they said, and then we really felt the Spirit move one day. And we ended up feeling like we wanted to serve each other communion, this beautiful sacred meal. And so they said, we just grabbed the bread and we threw it over the wall and we served each other communion. How about that, right? It says, this love doesn't stop at borders or fences or walls. This love knows no bounds. And it's that love that Jesus is doing to form us into a new family, that we can see that we've got something to show the world right now about the love of God in a world that's so hostile, so fearful, right? That's what's driving our country right now. It's fear and other things too. But fear is part of it. You know that, and we know the promise of Scripture is that love casteth out fear. But we also see that fear casteth out love, that it doesn't make much room for love when fear is driving our policies and our rhetoric. And we end up, if you look at history, doing really terrible things when fear drives us, right? So I think it's a beautiful time to proclaim that love. And one other place that I've learned that, this absolutely boundless grace of God is from traveling to the Middle East and to Iraq. My first trip to Iraq, as some of you may know, I was in March of 2003. So this month has been the anniversary of that. It was also during the Shock and Awe campaign, during the bombing of Baghdad, which began in March of 2003. And I was there with an amazing group of people, pastors, doctors and nurses, grandparents. We had veterans, former veterans for peace, so many different folks. And we were there together to bear witness, to stand against the war, to stand against violence, to volunteer in hospitals and meet with families. And one of the things that happened, there's so many things that happened, but as the bombs began to fall on Baghdad, over 900 a day, we lived in Baghdad and saw some of the most horrific things that I've ever experienced in my life. But in the middle of that horror, we experienced light kind of coming through the cracks of all the brokenness, of love kind of moving in between those spaces. And one of the most powerful worship services I've ever experienced was in Baghdad. And it was in the, right on the brink of the bombing, and there were hundreds and hundreds of Christians in Iraq that had gotten together to pray for peace, all different denominations. And during this worship service, it was so packed that people were kind of spilling into the streets, holding candles in solidarity. They couldn't even get in. And the bishops from all the different denominations stood up together in solidarity, and they read a statement that they had collaboratively written. And it was a statement to Muslim people, and it said, quite simply, we want you to know today that we love you, and that we know that you are created in the image of God, that we are made from the same dirt of this earth that God breathed life into, that we come from the same dysfunctional family of Abraham and Sarah. And they said, we are praying for you, and we're praying for us, that we would remember Jesus. And they pointed to the cross, and they said, this is a time where Jesus shines bright, where we see on the cross what love looks like as it stares evil in the face. We see the perfect nonviolence, the forgiving love of Jesus, a way that we can interact with evil without becoming it. And then the whole place started singing Amazing Grace in Arabic. And my Arabic's not great, so I just kind of hummed along, you know. But then I was started getting, you know, it's so moving to hear Amazing Grace in Arabic. And I've got tears rolling down my face. And I kind of beelined forward after the service to grab one of the bishops. And I'm, you know, I got my charismatic fire going. I'm like, Pastor, I said, I've never experienced a worship service quite this powerful. And I said, and I'm you know, kind of talking real fast without thinking a little bit. And I said, I had no idea there were so many Christians in Iraq. And the pastor goes, yeah, this is where it started. The bishop says back to me, he says, oh, this is the land of your ancestors. Don't forget that. He said, he pointed out the door and he goes, that's the Tigris River and the Euphrates. Have you heard of them? And he said, the Garden of Eden's right down the street. We can take you there if you want. You know, he said, this is the land of your ancestors. And then he said, you didn't invent Christianity in North America. You just domesticated it. And he said, you go back and you tell the church in North America that we are praying for them. We're praying for them to remember who they are at such a time as this. To remember who they are. And I think of Dr. King as he said that these are extreme times that we're living in. And the question isn't whether or not we will be extremists, but what kind of extremists we will be. Will we be extremists for hatred or extremists for love? And the world has seen enough extremists for hatred. But I think our invitation today is to shine God's light, the light of God's love in this dark world, right? To bear witness. And that doesn't just mean going to war zones. I think sometimes it can be easier to love people on the other side of the world than the people right next to us in our community. And so as we think of what it means to be God's people right now, I think a part of what it means is that we are to transcend all of these divisions, all of the walls of hostility. Some of them are very subtle, right? The ways that we kind of build walls, even within our own congregations, that we build walls in our own hearts of unforgiveness, that we build walls with people who are unlike us. And sometimes one of the most radical things we can do is have dinner with someone who's different and begin to build a friendship. There's a group of Muslims in the United States that their whole motto is to move from fear to friendship. And they have Muslim families with open tables that invite Christians and Jewish folks and others just to eat together. And I think this meal is a symbol of the holy redemption of what God's doing in the world, right? That it's been said that the communion table is it's a sacrament, because what it does is we are all being transformed into something new together, even as we think of the elements of bread and wine. Someone has said that it's interesting it's not bread and water, because You have bread, the stable, everyday food that keeps us alive, with wine, which is often more of a luxury for the rich. And yet those are together at this table because they remind us that we don't have rich and poor in the church. We only have family. And these elements come together. And if anyone comes to this table with their stomach aching and hunger, we're not living into what it means to be the family of God. But we remind it as we look at the bread. It was Gandhi that said, in a world where so many are starving, it only makes sense that God would come to us as food. Right? So God comes to us as food. But the other thing they have in common is bread is made from grain that has to be crushed. You know, grapes that are crushed to make wine, that we are crushed into a new creation, that we are being transformed into this body. And when we consume this meal, it consumes us, and we become a part of Christ's love in the world that is reconciling and healing all things. And so as we prepare for communion, I brought you a little audio clip of... As we were leaving Iraq, my friend was leaving Iraq. He heard these kids singing a song that he recognized. And I would have never recognized it because I'm tone deaf. But he's a musician. And he heard them singing in Arabic. And he said, listen to that. And he grabbed a recorder. And he recorded these kids singing the beautiful, historic, spiritual freedom song, We Shall Overcome. So we'll close and prepare for communion as we listen to the children of Iraq in the middle of the war singing, We Shall Overcome.
نحن نمشي يدا بيد اليوم نحن لسنا خائفين نحن لسنا خائفين نحن لسنا خائفين اليوم في أعماق قلبي أنا أؤمن نحن لسنا خائفين اليوم We shall overcome.